The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, we've been looking at the history of the New Testament canon, especially in the period between 170 to 220, that period in which we're able to get, at an earliest point, a very clear picture of what the state of the New Testament in the church is. And you'll remember that much of our discussion has been set in the context of the debate concerning the character of the certain heretical developments and how they interact in the life of the church in developing a consciousness of canon. Specifically, does the heresy create the idea of canon, or does it promote its recognition? And we were then dealing with that debate between Harnack and Zahn, as it could be put in terms of people, right at the end of our discussion, and had been introducing some more purely historical grounds that bear on the side of the one Zahn position that support the notion that the idea of canon is not something abruptly thrust into the life of the church around 150 AD, but is a matter of a more organic, spontaneous development so far as the consciousness of the church is concerned. Are there any questions on that point before we go ahead? Yes. I had four factors that I set out. The last point that I made concerned, as I put it, the actual state of the New Testament around 200. That is, that what we observe there is a situation where there's a core on which there's universal agreement, and then a periphery about which there's some disagreement. And that situation, I think, tells against the notion of a formally, abruptly and formally determined and introduced conception of canon. All right, let's move on, which is to say go back to the period 140 to 170. Now, in general, we can say of this period that it's a period in which the still young church is struggling for its existence. And in that struggle, the efforts of those who are active in the defense of the church, and as we're able to be aware of that now, active, those efforts, active in writing, the efforts of those who write in defense of the church were directed in one of two basic directions. We can schematize this way. There is an inward direction or look in defensive writings. That is, those efforts that are directed against heresy, which in this period is becoming so serious. Heresy in this period becoming an especially serious threat to the Orthodox faith. These are the years, for instance, in which Gnosticism and Martianism are taking hold of and beginning to exert a dominant influence. So of one basic direction in which defensive efforts of those writing on behalf of Orthodox faith is what we could describe as an inward direction, that is directed toward error emerging within the church, to heresy. A second direction is that writing which is looking outward, in an outward direction. What we could also describe generally as the apologetic literature that develops. Efforts then in defense of Christianity before heathen authorities more generally, the heathen non-Christian population as a whole, and in a situation where that both authorities and general population are often quite hostile, periods of intense persecution at this time. So there are these two areas of concern, these two directions of address. It's precisely now the results of this, of the latter attempt, that is the apologetic undertaking, the outward look. It's just the results of that attempt for which we have a substantial quantity preserved to us from this period. But now the observation that bears on our concern here, in the writing of such literature, that is the apologetic literature, there is little opportunity or reason to reflect, at least formally, little reason to reflect concerning the structure and contents of Scripture. This apologetic literature. In other words, to put the point another way, when you're dealing with non-Christians, the question of canon is not the first thing that comes on the agenda. First thing you deal with. At least I hope it isn't. As to the inner directed materials, where there must have certainly and necessarily been some concerns, even extended indications of on the canon question, that body of material has almost completely disappeared. We know of it only by way of title and a few fragments that have come down or quoted by others. So you see the basic profile that I'm trying to draw here, and what this adds up to then, the pattern by which literature from this period is extant to us, all this adds up to what it makes for is that the study of the canon in this period becomes rather difficult now. We are, as we compare with the period in which we were just occupied, we are, so to speak, plunged from a period of considerable light into now rather considerable darkness. And this means that beginning with this period, moving back as far as we can go to beginning, we are now going to have to content ourselves largely with indirect evidence and with inferences that can be drawn. We're going to have to be more largely concerned now with indirect evidence and inference for the study of the canon question, with recognizing the danger that attaches to that and the tentativeness with which we need to be content. But the situation, as I've just been putting it, is perhaps not as bad as I'm making it to sound, because I think we can get some very definite indications, even if the picture can't be sketched out as articulately as we might like, as much as we were able to for the period we were just in. Now, I think a striking and an interesting situation is this, that what proves to be most helpful to us in getting our understanding for this period, what is most valuable in giving us a picture, is not the material that comes out of an Orthodox context, but heretical material proves to be the most substantial help here. And that brings us now to become more specific and to talk, first of all, about a document bearing the title Gospel of Truth. The Gospel of Truth, which is by far the most important single piece of evidence for this period. Now, the Gospel of Truth, its existence or reference to it, has been known for a long time, down through the history of the church, because it's referred to, say, by Irenaeus, by writers from the late second century. It was known, however, only by title and by citations that others made of it. Its own discovery has been rather recent, and in fact, in this century. So that has been a rather interesting development, that a document known down through the centuries of the Church's life finally becomes extant to us in this century. It was discovered among the manuscripts of the library of a Gnostic sect, which library was discovered in 1945 in the location of Nag Hammadi, the material often then being, the material as a whole being referred to by that designation, on a location near the Nile River in Upper Egypt. The text, then, has become available in translation and can be found in the volume by R.M. Grant, Gnosticism, pages 146 to 162. There has been then discussion concerning the significance of this document for the from a number of angles concerning the life of the church in this period. But comment on the significance for the New Testament canon is to be found above all in a very important article, which I'm really, for the purposes of our discussion here, largely piggybacking on, making use of. And that is the article by the Dutch scholar, I think just recently dead, W.C. van Unnik, an article entitled The Gospel of Truth and the New Testament. The Gospel of Truth and the New Testament. And that's an article in the volume, The Young Codex, which is another way of referring to these materials, or part of the materials found there in 1945 on location in Upper Egypt, volume edited by F.L. Cross. In this volume, The Young Codex, the Van Unnik article is pages 81 to 129. So many of the more specific questions you might have then, don't hesitate to ask. If I can answer it, I will. But I imagine the specific detailed questions that I may leave you in mind with can be answered either by reading the document itself and then going to the extensive commentary of Thun Unnek. And we can say that really the significance of this document is still a matter of some discussion, some debate. Its significance, then we can say we're at a time where that significance has not really been fully explicated or settled for the New Testament canon question. But as I bring it into our discussion here, I do so because, in my opinion, as I've been able to follow the discussion, I believe it is a piece of evidence that is just destructive of the views of Harnack as we have been considering them. Just a little bit of further background on this gospel of truth. It is written by Valentinus, at Rome, and dated then between 140 and 145. Dated in the early 140s of Valentinian authorship. The document is often referred to in Latin, that is, has been referred to down through church history in Latin as the Evangelium Veritatis, Gospel of Truth. But the document discovered is in Coptic and appears to have been a Coptic translation of a Greek original. And, as I said, dated around 140 to 145. Now, of course, this is a piece of evidence which wasn't at Harnack's disposal. He couldn't interact with it. The reaction of von Kampenhausen, who, you remember, stands in the Harnack tradition, is, in effect, to dispute what we have just affirmed on the basis of the work of Van Unnek and others, to dispute its Valentinian authorship and a dating of in the early 140s. He puts it this way, von Kampenhausen, on page 140 of a volume that I've already assigned pages in his work, The Origin of the New Testament, or The Formation of the Christian Bible, the English title. On page 140 in the footnote there, he says there's nothing to prove either Valentinian authorship or a pre-Martian date, and considers, after he puts it that way, then he says he considers that these conclusions, that is, Valentinian authorship and a date before Martian, are less probable. So that is an issue on which there's not a consensus, and I won't make the effort here to argue with von Kampenhausen, simply refer you to von Unnek's treatment and his conclusions as to the Valentinian origin and a date at 140. The document, then, was received by the Gnostics as a sort of fifth gospel alongside of the canonical four. But as you'll discover, if you take even just a moment to look at the document itself, it's not at all like the four gospels. That is, it is not a gospel in the sense of a narration following a narrative line concerning the ministry of Jesus. It's more of a homily. It's a devotional piece or reflection, more of a sermon and not a gospel. The observation then that we have to make about the gospel of truth, this document, is that it very clearly makes use in its composition, it makes use of the gospels. Some dispute whether or not it makes use of Mark, but it makes use of the gospels, many of the Pauline epistles, and Hebrews, and Revelation. Clear use of Hebrews and Revelation, as well as Gospels and Pauline material. Also, more debatable is whether it is making use of Acts, 1 John, 1 Peter. In other words, this document, in its composition, draws on practically the same books which make up our New Testament. And it makes use of only these. There is nothing now considered to be canonical, nothing of that kind used in the production of this document. Further now, not only is use made of these materials, but the manner in which they are treated, the manner in which these documents are treated, proves that they had for the author of the Gospel of Truth authority. They had, in some sense, they were special for him. They had authoritative significance for him. And inasmuch as he treats or makes use of only these materials and not other materials that are circulating in the church, appeals to only these as authoritative, we can then press the point that they are viewed by him, these materials indicated are viewed by him as making up an authoritative collection. He draws on just these materials. These materials convey the good news which he is seeking to reproduce and then in fact proceeds to pervert in the gospel, or in the document, the Gospel of Truth. You can see then the significance for the history of the New Testament canon that I'm seeking to draw out here. What the Gospel of Truth brings us to consider is that between 140 and 150, there is a collection of writings known at Rome, a collection of writings known at Rome and accepted as authoritative, a collection which is virtually identical with our New Testament. Especially worth noting is that this collection includes even Hebrews and Revelation, books whose place in the canon was for a long time after this point debated, uncertain. More pointedly then, around 150, before 150, this canon, in the sense of this authoritative collection, this canon is functional. This canon was in use at Rome. Further, we can go on to make this observation. In view of the way in which these books are used in the gospel of truth, we can infer, it's fair to infer, that they have enjoyed authority for some time already. As they appear to have made up for him a collection, an authoritative collection, that collection must have already existed for some time. How much, of course, is only a matter of speculation from the vantage point of the document. But the point is simply that the document as composed around 140 points us to the fact that this collection had already been existing. Further, we need to emphasize that this gospel of truth is written well before the condemnation of Martian. Written before the condemnation of Martian, well before that time, and also then the gospel of truth dates well before the time which Harnack and others ascribe to the origin of Martian's canon. The gospel of this, in some respects, is a bottom line to the discussion we were having earlier between Zahn and Martian, that the gospel of truth, in its characters indicated, is certainly to is to be given a date which is clearly before the origin, or the date even that Martian would assign to the origin, Harnack would assign to the origin of Martian's canon. I think also of interest to bring into our discussion here is a quotation that we find in Tertullian. Yes, go ahead. The document itself, you know, as you would look at it in Grant, would not identify itself as, you know, being bit by I, Valentinus. That's, you know, if that were the case, there probably wouldn't be debate about it. But the reasoning for being confident, again, you know, it's not so much as suspended here on Valentinus having written it. The more critical issue for our discussion is a pre-Martian date. And the case for that in detail you can pick up in someone like Benunnik. But also, and what I want to just read here, we have a very early testimony to its Valentinian origin. And I think it's interesting to, it puts things in a certain perspective for us to see how Tertullian, writing, say, around 200, a little bit later, how he refers to the, describes the situation. It's in a situation where he's setting off, in general, an orthodox appeal to Scripture and handling of Scripture from a heretical one. And as he looks at the heretics, he makes this statement: one man perverts the Scripture with his hand, another their meaning by his exposition. And then, to illustrate that, he goes on this way: for although Valentinus seems to use the entire volume, that is, the whole Scripture, he has nonetheless laid violent hands on the truth, only with a more cunning mind and skill than Martian. So we're going to get a comparison now between Valentinus and Martian. Martian expressly and openly used the knife, not the pen. In other words, Martian did a hatchet job on the Scriptures. Martian expressly and openly used the knife, not the pen, since he made such an excision of the Scriptures as suited his own subject matter. Valentinus, however, abstained from such excision because he did not invent scriptures to square with his own subject matter, but adapted his matter to the scriptures. And yet he took away more and added more by removing the proper meaning of every particular word and adding fantastic arrangements of things which have no real existence. Now, just very quickly, to sum up what's being said here, as he contrasts, Tertullian contrasting Martian and Valentinus. By the way, that's from a document, the prescriptions against heretics, the prescriptions against heretics, chapter 38, lines 7 and following, or right at the end of that chapter. What Tertullian is telling us is that Martian eliminated what didn't suit him in Scripture. Valentinus, on the other hand, uses the entire New Testament, but distorts it by imposing his own fantastic scheme on it. And the point that I'm wanting especially to bring out here for our discussion is that Tertullian, writing at the end of the century, regards Martian as having a different New Testament than himself, but Valentinus as having the same New Testament. Valentinus having the same scripture. So I think then the existence of the gospel of truth with the character that we've been indicating here is to be seen as a rather decisive blow against any attempt to date the idea of the canon beyond the middle of the second century as the creation of Martian. Okay, those remarks on the gospel of truth. Secondly, as evidence for the state of things in this period, we want now to talk about Martian's canon. Martian's canon. You see, once it becomes clear from a variety of factors that we've already been touching on, once it becomes clear that Martian is not the creator of the New Testament canon, then how are we going to explain his canon, its origin? His canon, you see, is now a historical phenomenon for which we have to provide some other explanation. And so it turns out that just as it is, Martian's canon becomes a piece of evidence for the prior existence of the Church's New Testament in this period. The historical logic that's at work here, you see, is this, that we have Martian's canon and the Church's canon, and that the two stand in such a relationship to each other that if we disprove the priority of Martian's canon, then the priority of the Church's canon to that of Martian's is at least strongly indicated. In the abstract, of course, it would be possible for them not to have any particular genetic connection, any tie to each other, but I don't think that anyone will want to argue that way. They're obviously related in one direction or the other. So to disprove Martian's priority is to point toward the priority of the Church's canon. So that what we want then to recognize or to suggest as a true state of affairs is something like this, that what has happened, in fact, is that Martian goes to work on the canon, or the body of authoritative writings that is already existing in the Church. And with reference to that already existing authoritative collection, he trims it down, he pairs it to suit his interests. As Tertullian said, he uses a knife. Now, something of the cannon which Marcion went to work on with his scalpel, that I think we can infer from the finished dissection, if we can use a more elevated figure here. We can infer that, looking at his cannon, we can infer that Martians had the same, what he went to work on had the same basic structure as his, that is, it's made up of a gospel section and an epistle or apostles section. A collection that has the basic structure, you see, of the historical facts and their interpretation. In accepting all of Paul's letters except what, as you recall? The pastoral epistles. In accepting all but the pastorals, Martian has the heart of the epistles section. It's true that he has only one gospel, but this, as you recall, a radically edited Gospel of Luke, this, so far as we're able to tell, because we don't have it extant, we only know of Martian's Luke from the citations that others have made of it. It appears, however, to have, in its being edited, had incorporated into it elements that can be traced to the other three Gospels, but nothing from any of the various apocryphal Gospels that make their appearance at this time elsewhere. In other words, it appears, or maybe that puts it too strongly, at least the best presumption is that it was the four canonical Gospels coming down eventually then to the radically edited Luke. It is the four canonical Gospels exclusively that serve as Martian's source. So the fact of Martian's base, the basic structure of Martian's, the basic skeleton of his canon, gospel and epistle, that points us then to the framework of the authoritative collection he was working with. And then further, the fact that Martian rejects other books, such as the Catholic epistles, 1 Peter and 1 John being rather strongly attested for this period. The fact that he rejects other books, that no more proves that they were not part of the church's canon at this time and at his disposal. The fact that he rejects them, I'm saying, no more proves that they were not part of the church's canon than does his rejection of the Old Testament, which we noted earlier. Better say that again now, drawing a comparison here. The fact that he rejects certain books out of the Catholic epistles no more proves that they were not part of the church's canon that was at his disposal than does his rejection of the Old Testament prove that it was not a part of the church's canon. And you remember there's no question that the Old Testament was accepted. All right, those observations on how Martian's work proves to be significant. Thirdly here, we can draw attention to the evidence that we have in Justin Martyr, whose name may be familiar to some of you now anyway as the first great apologist in the history of the church. dates approximate 100 to 165. And we cite him now as an example to illustrate the best that is to be gotten from Orthodox writers in this period, the most that we can get from the materials out of an Orthodox context extant to us from this period. In the course of his writings, Justin mentions a description of Christian worship. And he tells us that among the elements of Christian worship, what takes place is that the remembrance of the apostles and the writings of the prophets are read. He says, the remembrances of the apostles and the writings of the apostles are read. Now, in that expression, or in that phrase, the expression, the writings of the prophets, the term prophets there surely has a so-called synecdochic reference. Everybody knows what that means? A synecdoche is a literary device where you use a designation which technically refers to only part of an entity to refer to the entire entity. A reference by which a term for the part refers to the whole, put it another way. So when I'm saying that what we are encountering here is obviously a synecdochic reference or use of prophets, that's saying that Justin is using the term prophets here not simply to refer to a part of the Old Testament canon, but to refer to the Old Testament canon as a whole, to refer to the Old Testament as a whole. And that so-called synecdochic usage is well attested in the New Testament, where the term law, for instance, will be used to describe the whole Old Testament, or the term prophet can be used to refer to material that is, in technically speaking, in a song. So the expression, writings of the prophet, refers to the fact that the Old Testament is read in the worship of the church. Now you'll recall that connected with that body of, the writings of the prophets read in the church is a body of writings known as the Remembrances of the Apostles. The Remembrances of the Apostles. Now we can make a couple of observations as to this expression. I think you can see that it is placed on a par with the Old Testament. What are read are the remembrances of the apostles and the writings of the prophets. These remembrances are placed on a par with the Old Testament, and it would also be fair, I think, by analogy, to infer that the term apostles in that expression, remembrances of the apostles, has as prophets a synecdochic force. So if I'm not laboring this point too much, what Justin is saying, in other words, what he's saying in effect, is that in the worship of the church, the Old Testament and New Testament are being read. As writings of the prophets is a synecdochic reference to the Old Testament, so remembrances of the apostles is a synecdochic reference to a new body or collection, which we could also term then the New Testament. So we have that that general reference, which I think is instructive, as we've been trying to indicate. But now if we push on and ask, what then exactly is the content? What books, more specifically, make up this Remembrances collection? Then we are raising a question, I think, that we really can't answer with any sort of precision or clarity. Clearly, it would appear to involve the Gospels, because of that use of that term, remembrances, what are being remembered by the apostles, particularly concerning Christ, his ministry. But beyond that, it's very difficult to be specific. What we are left with doing is going to the writings of Justin and seeing what he considers to be a part of authoritative scripture that is would have a place along with the Old Testament being used in the worship of the church. And that is complicated by the fact that Justin is often very free, somewhat careless in the way that he cites. But we can put the matter something like this, that Justin appears to have made use of and to be viewing the following as authoritative: Romans, 1 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Colossians, 2 Thessalonians, Hebrews, 1 Peter, the book of Acts, and the so-called Didache, the teaching of the 12 apostles. I'll go through those again. It's not, I think, a vital concern that you get down every item. Romans, 1 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Colossians, 2 Thessalonians, Hebrews, 1 Peter, Acts, and the Didache. These are viewed by him as authoritative in the sense that he refers to them, that they determine his views and shape his mode of expression. So you see on what kind of tentative ground we are at this point. And before I pick up a question, the bottom line then that I want to, something of a bottom line for our look at things in this period, especially as we look at the work of Justin, there's nothing in Justin that conflicts with the inference that we draw, inferences that we have drawn on more firm ground, I think, in the Gospel of Truth. Yeah, I should have been clear. That's a quote, and it can be found in his apology. Do Justin in blue here. His apology, part one, section 67, which is in can be found most conveniently probably for you in the volume by Bettinson. I think probably if you've had ancient church, you've been assigned, you had assignment in here, Early Christian Fathers. You know that document or that book at all? Well, you'll find it easily enough if you want to look for it. Page 86. Where you'll see there's just, it's in a context where he's dealing with, particularly with Jewish opposition. And he just refers in that context, in this way, to the worship of the church. So far as getting an impression as a whole, there's substantial material from Justin. Any other questions on what we've been looking at? Okay, yes, go ahead. Didache. No, it dates there's some dispute about its dating. It's extant. It can even be put by some people in the first century, although I question that. I think it's more in the early part of the second century. And it's structured. It's the teaching of the 12 apostles. It's structured on an input from each of the apostles, and is basically has kind of a moralistic tone to it. It's not a narrative. It's not anything like a gospel. Yeah, you would find that if you've learned your Greek studying New Testament Greek, it would not be so difficult for you to begin to work in that material as it would in the pre-Koine or in the classical Greek. But what you run into, what would be the large problem for you, would be a much expanded vocabulary. The New Testament, after all, has a rather small vocabulary. And as you begin to branch out in other writings, then that would be the main problem you'd run into. Yeah, Valentinus would be earlier than Martian. Now, the question is whether or not he's the author of the Gospel of Truth. And so the issue is, but as I said earlier, the issue is not so much whether or not he wrote it. You see, we have the testimony of Tertullian and really Irenaeus that he did write it, and then Unic, from the viewpoint of modern scholarship, confirms that. But the more critical issue is the date, whenever it was written. And there are independent considerations, which I couldn't spell out here, that apart from the issue of Valentinian authorship, date it in Rome before 150, which is critical with reference to the debate with Harnack. Now, as I said, then Van Kampenhuysen wants to challenge that. And so we get into a... We're here in an area where there is just, lots of, there's not a consensus among contemporary scholarship on historical data.